Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello, and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 16th of June. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Halsby.
It's Father's Day, Kev. You've been spoilt rotten?
Well, not Father's Day here.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So it's a strange one, really.
Yeah, do they have an equivalent? Because obviously, you know, it's Father's Day kind of starting off as an early 20th century celebration in the US. And then obviously it came rippled over to the UK.
I think it was started much the same like Mother's Day. It was started by the card companies, not Valentine.
Yeah, 1914, apparently.
Yeah, so no.
Okay.
Been moving into the villa in the North Coast, so it's been hectic, so it's the last thing on my mind, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and how was your trip over here? Obviously, we caught up in the week.
Yeah, the trip was good. I was in a situation where I was doing something personal in Ireland on the Saturday, and then on the Sunday, we went to visit one of the assets for Carillion Diamond, but that, I think, is for another day. We will do a podcast separately on that, I think.
Right.
And then I went to London. Yeah, and we did a few things in London. Me and you both went to the Aterian presentation that was held there in the City of London, which was very useful, I think. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was good to catch up with Charles and Simon, and it was good to see the presentation just to kind of remind how many assets that they've got. You know, obviously, Morocco alone, I think there's something in the region of between 17 and 19 licenses. And then obviously, you've got the Botswana licenses, and then also the HCK licenses, the lithium licenses down in the south of Rwanda as well, plus the potential comptoir trading arm of the company. So, really good to be reminded. There was I thought, very good questions from shareholders or potential shareholders, the people that were there that were sort of high net worths that were interested potentially in the company. Charles answered all the questions. I think Simon Rollison gave him, as one of the investors, summed it up. He gave him a geology masterclass, didn't he? And he was, I think he was quite blown away with the way that how Simon explained all the geology and how these sort of minerals are deposited in the rocks itself. So yeah, very, very interesting. Enjoyed it.
Good. Yeah, no, I thought it was very, very good. I mean, the number of assets that Aterian got is quite incredible. And the joint venture with Rio Tinto, and then you've got the different assets in Morocco, all of which could be substantial. I mean, they are focusing now, I think, on just three or four. So, yeah, very, very interesting. And I think, again, another one of those is just flying under the radar, I think.
Yeah.
People just don't, I think, quite realize what assets they've got.
No, I agree. Let's have a just quick look at some of the news. I mean, the main news stories this week have been related to the manifestos, obviously the upcoming election, 4th of July. Tories released their manifesto on Tuesday. Nothing really any shock in there. A revival of the Help to Buy scheme, which obviously maintains stamp duty threshold at 45,000 for first-time buyers. Abolish national insurance for self-employed. Tougher sentences to crimes and plans to build new prisons. Obviously, Rwandan flights, which is kind of on topic at the moment, regular flights, increased defence spending to 2.5%. So nothing really, any surprises there. And then Labour announced their manifesto on Thursday. Again, not really any surprises, but I think things like recruiting mental health staff, corporation tax good held at 25%, establishing a national wealth fund for various industries. On immigration, they want to obviously scrap the Rwanda scheme, so nothing really surprising there. But the one that surprised me was the fact that they want to try and build 1.5 million new homes, which seems like quite an ambitious plan to me. What are your thoughts on those manifestos?
But is this not a manifesto promise that's rolled out every general election?
Yeah, absolutely.
And then about 200,000 homes get built. You know, I mean, I think you can take everything in the manifesto with a huge pinch of salt and then another huge pinch of something else as well.
Yeah.
It just doesn't smell so good. So
doesn't smell so good. Yeah, I mean, I think the big shocker for Labour was for industry was the fact that they confirmed it will not issue new North Sea oil and gas licences if it wins the election, as it sets out its plan to make the UK a clean energy superpower. The Labour manifesto says that the party will deliver a green prosperity plan to invest in the climate transition, which it claims will create 650,000 green jobs, cut bills, and secure energy independence. So for any of these companies that are exploring in the North Sea, Irish Sea, etc., you just don't know what's going to happen, do you? It's all sort of uncertain.
Yeah, no, let's not have any more licenses so we can bring in gas from other places. that was more expensive, and that we have no security of our own oil and gas. Yeah, let's do that. That's pretty sensible.
Crazy one, yeah. So that all, there's just so many different means of debates on all the different channels, and it kind of, you get an overload of it. So I'll probably, like, you'll be glad when it's all done and dusted, sort of, you know, beginning of July. But the other news story, and not to dwell too much here, the sad news was, I guess, more of a rest in peace, was Dr. Michael Mosley, who passed and was on holiday, wasn't he, with his wife and friends on a Greek island, and he went on a trek. It seems like in the sort of hottest part of the day, 40-degree heat, must have become sort of disorientated and went off the path. And I guess it was his downfall in the end, sort of misadventure, wasn't it? Because he sort of was stumbling around and potentially got heat stroke and sadly passed away. What did you make of that story?
Yeah, it's a bit of a, I don't think the guy, I mean, obviously he must have got lost, you would imagine, because otherwise he couldn't have used a lot of common sense to go out on that walk at 35, 40 degrees centigrade. And then, you know, I don't know, did he think he was 25 again or what? I don't know, it seems very bizarre.
Strange one, isn't it? Okay. Let's move on to our first guest this week. We're joined by Jonathan Dixon, VP Co-Head of EMEA International Corporate Services for OTC Markets. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey, Phil. How you doing?
Absolutely. Yeah, fine. Thank you. So, I mean, we see a lot of this on the UK markets. We see an RNS announcement that a company has been admitted to the OTC markets. And obviously, that's an American financial market providing price and liquidity information for almost 12,400 over-the-counter securities. The group has its headquarters in New York City. OTC traded securities are organized into three markets to inform investors of opportunities and risks: OTCQX, OTCQB, and Pink, sometimes referred to as the Pink Sheets. Do you want to just talk the listeners through the difference in these three different sort of trading securities and exactly how OTC was formed in the first place?
Yeah, sure. No, I appreciate it. So I'll start from the beginning. So as a market, you've obviously heard of New York and NASDAQ. OTC Markets Group is the third stock market in the United States, but it's actually the biggest for international public companies which have their primary listing outside of the US. And the reason being is, if you have your primary listing outside of the US on a qualified foreign exchange, such as London, such as Aquis, Euronext, Deutsche Börse, TSX, examples, you can have a US dollar quote in US market hours for US investors of your ordinary share from your home market without SEC reporting, without Sarbanes-Oxley risk, without reconciling to US GAAP. So broadly speaking, you're getting a US dollar quote of your ordinary share, which actually prints in your home market, but without the complexity, risk, duplicative reporting of an exchange listing on New York or NASDAQ. To your point, we have three tiers. We have the Pink open market, made up of around 10,000 securities. A lot of it's very light touch regulation. It is the traditional over-the-counter. So what you'll find is New York and NASDAQ D-lists and reorganized companies, but then you'll find Rolls-Royce and Nestlé ADR. So it's a massive market. But above that, we have two fully regulated tiers by the SEC and FINRA, albeit the issuers which trade on there do not need to register because they can rely on their own market disclosure. That's called 12G32B, by the way, the foreign private issuer exemption. It's classic S&C terminology. It's a lot of numbers and letters. But again, that affords them to be able to do this. So OTCQB, venture stage market, about 1,600 companies. And what you'll find on there, like I say, aid resource companies, small biotech, pre-revenue, TSXV, ASX companies, companies that just want to get their access to the US. And then above that is OTCQX, that's our top tier. That's where you'll find the likes of Heineken, Adidas, Roche, Danone, Sainsbury's, Marks and Spencer's, Tate & Lyle, EasyJet, global brands, big companies that want to access the US, but absolutely do not want to register with the SEC. Roche wants to rely on their Swiss disclosure, which is probably as good, if not better, than SEC reporting. Publicis in Paris on Euronext and BNP Paribas and companies like that. So that's the market as a whole. Apologies, I know that was quite a lot of information, but that is it.
So, John, yeah, it's very interesting. It takes me to the scene in The Wolf of Wall Street, where he was
pick
talking
up
about
the phone and start dialing.
You know, he pinks. What do you mean? 50% commission instead of 1%. So tell me what over-the-counter actually really means, or where did that come from?
Yeah, so it's funny you should say that. We always have to caveat this. People always associate us with the Wolf of Wall Street and the Pink Sheets. Ironically, we bought the Pink Sheets, so we had nothing to do with it. But our CEO, Cromwell Coulson, years ago, bought the Pink Sheets, which was a traditional phone book, and it was full of, like a phone book, with bidden offers. pick up the phone and you trade orders over the counter. He digitalized it. So he wanted to take it away from the book and stick it into the machines, as he says. So now it's a fully electronic order book. And we have 100 odd market makers which quote these securities in our market. So yes, and broadly speaking, you know, the market was really came into its own when Sarbanes-Oxley came into effect, because you've got primary listed issuers throughout Europe, Danone being one. Danone had or has its primary listing still in Paris on Euronext, disclosing in English. They did have a dual listing on the New York Stock Exchange. Sarbanes-Oxley came into effect. Danone said, we want nothing to do with this. Sarbanes-Oxley's too much risk. So they delisted and they land on our pink market. Then we created OCCQX because we realized you've got a company like Danone, multi-billion market cap issuer, yogurt's on every shelf in America, and now US investors can't trade that security. So OTCQX was created in, and the 12G32B foreign private issuer exemption in its current form was also created. So that's, and then Danone went there. Then we got AXA in Zurich, and then a lot of mega caps and started to join the market, realizing they could get this US access without the risk. And then about 6 years.
What is that risk? So sorry to interrupt. What is the problem with the SEC? Like, why doesn't a company want to be governed by the likes of the equivalent of the FCA or something like that?
So the US is very litigious for a start. You know, we joke in the UK about everyone suing everyone over there, but it is, you know, there is that risk. And when you're registering securities in the US on a national exchange like NASDAQ or New York, you're subject to the SEC oversight, which can be fairly punchy. You also have to do quarterly reporting, which is expensive and hard work. But Sarbanes-Oxley is the big one. That's the one which, you know, effectively puts directors at risk personally when they do something wrong. So again, the likes of Enron, it was born out of those, Enron, WorldCom, et cetera. And so that's why typically you don't see more international companies dual listing on New York or NASDAQ unless they've got firepower and they're ready for the table.
Maybe you should change its name from over the counter, under the counter, because it sounds like a way of getting away from that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah, but it was interesting that you said this is the biggest market. Now, how do you define that it's the biggest market? It's the most trades or just the biggest market caps with all of the companies put together? How do you define it's the biggest market in the US?
It's the amount of listings. So technically, they're not cross trades. So, you know, we talk about on OCCQX having BNP Paribas and all the, you know, these big names. But on the pink market, any mega cap in the world, which is primary listed outside of the US, which is not on New York or NASDAQ, is more than likely going to be on our pink market, because that is the way that those US investors can get access to that security. So as I mentioned, LVMH, Rolls-Royce, L'Oreal, these big world's biggest companies, Mercedes is an example, they're there. We are that marketplace. So that's why we define it as the largest in the US. Granted, they're not primary listed on our market. We are a secondary market. We do have some primary listings in the smaller US space, but generally, yeah, 90% of our work is in the international space.
And from a UK perspective, you know, if we were to go for AIM and some of the companies we cover, who's on the OTCB that you have?
Well, it's funny. I listen to your podcast all the time. And I was in the car the other day, and I know you had Oliver from Golden Metal on there. So obviously that's a really unique play for them. You know, tungsten assets in Nevada, US assets, as I say, they want to get access to US investors. And to your point, I'll come back to that, Kevin, in a minute. One of the biggest issues is there's a misconception that all US investors can just buy international securities. They can't. If there's no quote, they can't. And there typically is no quotes. The other part of this is if BlackRock want to buy an international security in London, for example, on AIM, yeah, of course they can. They're big enough to do it. They'll come straight in. But BlackRock are not interested in small AIM companies. It's third and fourth tier investors and institutions, it's family offices, it's retail, it's high net worth in the US that are willing to look at that. So that's, we solved that problem. Straight back to your point, Kevin, I think some of the ones that we've had on recently, Power Metal Resources, so Sean's very good on this. You know, he's not a cornerstone investor in the US with Power Metal. Critical Metals went on last week. Union Jack Oil went on as well. So we've got a few more applications in as we speak. So yeah, there's a few on that. Obviously, we've got the mega caps as well, but it's a slow burner because it's a big education piece. Hence, you know, why I'm talking to you guys. It is a big education's misconceptions around the pink market. With a lot of them are right, but a lot of them are wrong. It's a constant education piece.
So just tell us as well about because I want to know about the fungibility of it in terms of the shares. Is there a a commonality between the shares that are listed in the UK and on the OTC markets in terms of if there's a movement of 20%, would you expect that to ripple through from one market to the other?
Yeah, so it's the same shares. It's the ordinary share from the home market. We are the market for all level one American depository receipts. So 70% of all ADRs trade OTC. However, for the smaller companies, we tend not to set them up with the ADR because they're ordinary, will probably already be on pink.
Yeah.
Company. So the way it works is, let's call it sort of retail. So as I mentioned, about 100 market makers, all the usual guys, Citadel, Virtu, Stone, Exchange Street, quoting a foreign security in our market. And it's just an FX conversion from pounds to dollars or pence to cents.
Okay.
Let's assume Mr. Smith of Merrill Lynch in Chicago wants 10,000 shares of the Core Resources, which are on OTCQX. That order goes through, there's a five-letter ticket ending in F, punches it into his F, calls his broker, whatever he wants to do. That order gets routed to our market. Say Citadel's at the top of the book. Citadel will take that and they will trade that straight into London. It will trade, settle, print in London, boost liquidity in London, sit on the local register as Merrill Lynch, so street name, not Mr. Smith, but Merrill Lynch. However, Mr. Smith of Merrill Lynch in Chicago has got 10,000 shares of the Core Resources in US dollars as a book entry in his account. If they're paying a dividend, that'd be managed by Merrill and FX by Merrill. If London is closed and New York is still open, there's that four-hour overlap. Same thing happens. The spread might widen a bit, but still the same FX conversion. Order comes in from Merrill, hits Virtu at the top of the book. They'll go short, so they'll hold its principal overnight. When London wakes up the next morning, they'll lay that order off in London, normally with winter floods, but that's where I'll hit the tape in London. So it is exactly the same share. The shares never actually leave London. They get clipped and reported in London.
Yeah.
Where it boosts liquidity, unlike in St. George's.
Yeah, I've been watching that with Gold and Metal Resources because there's been quite a few more buyers in London in the last month or two, in America, sorry, on the OTCB for Gold and Metal. And people have started to watch it in some of the Telegram groups as well as how much is being traded. And then obviously the next day, it then gets traded in London as well. So, yep. It's a very interesting concept and it's going to work because we need liquidity and there's a lot of liquidity there, obviously. I mean, from a US point of view, some of these stocks must seem so cheap to those US investors compared to what they have to pay for in the US. It must be incredible for them.
Yeah, well, we often talk about, you know, there's the valuation gap. We always talk about that with the US anyway. But to your point, Kevin, we don't compete with the London Stock Exchange or Deutsche Börse or Euronext or Aquis. We actually send liquidity back. So that's what we want to do. We have this little tagline, list local, trade global. But that's literally it. We want people to be champions of their own market, of their own country, raise money locally, but bolt on the US in order with us in order to get that flow back to investors who today can't buy your stock, but tomorrow can. That's kind of what it's all about. And to your point, yes, and it's also about getting your name out there. You know, the US is not a panacea when the lights go on and we create a ticker. It's also to do with getting your awareness out. So you've got to tell your story into the US as well because you're in a sea of thousands of equities. There is also a compliance element to this, and sorry for jumping the gun, but this is really important to mention. If you're not on the New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, OTCQX, or OTCQB, it is against U.S. state securities law. Everything in the U.S. is state by state. It's odd, but it is. It's against U.S. state securities law for brokers, banks, fund managers to recommend an international security to retail clients. So what that means is, you know, until a few weeks ago, if Raymond James in Dallas liked the Golden Metal story, they could not recommend that to their clients. They could not distribute research below institutional level. Now Golden Metal are on, Raymond James and Dallas like that story and they want to recommend it to their clients. They are fully compliant in Texas. So they can start sending out research, start recommending that security. So it's not just a matter of setting a ticker up and putting the lights on and plugging in the brokers. It's also a compliance element for that.
Yeah, interesting and good as well, I think. We look forward to speaking to you more, John. And I think, yeah, let's see where this all goes in terms of more and more companies. I think it's going to make sense that more and more companies do it just to create the liquidity. And as you said, the AIM companies can go on it. I presume main list can go on it. The Aquis companies can go on it. So yeah, it will be very interesting to see how this all develops.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thanks for your time today.
Absolutely. So Jonathan Dixon, VP Co-Head of EMEA for OTC Markets, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And on to our second guest this week, we welcome Sapan Guy, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome back, Sapan.
Hi, Phil. Good to be back.
Absolutely, yeah. So we've seen some exciting photos on X recently, and that obviously coincides with the fact that the company recently announced the pilot site construction for the Kasia Rutile graphite project in Malawi, progressing on schedule. Program includes constructing a test pit, water storage pond, and ore stockpile with a mobile fleet. The soft saprolite ore allows for easy mining without drilling or blasting. 8 boreholes are ready to supply water, and key contractors and consultants have been appointed. The circa 10-hectare site will feature a test pit, stockpiles, backfilling, grading, and rehabilitation demonstration pits. This pilot phase aims to restore land to its original agricultural productivity and will provide crucial data for the definitive feasibility study. Managing Director Frank Agar highlighted the project's timely progress and low operating costs. Does it feel like things are sort of finally progressing well now at Kasia, Sapan?
Look, I think from some of the images that we've shared across our announcements, our RNSs, you could probably see that there's a lot happening on the ground. Earthworks are happening, stockpile areas are being built, water storage is being built. You know, it's a proper project, although it's a pilot phase site. It's still, dare I say, a proper sizable project. And yeah, we're in the throes of essentially getting it up and running, doing a bit of dry mining, hydro mining, working out the best kind of permutations around those. We'll be processing the ore. Any products that we end up with through the process will end up with end users, future customers, downstream test work labs for us to just better understand our product once we're up and running as a full scale mine.
Absolutely, yeah. As I say, I alluded to the top there, the some of the pictures on X look. There's some really good aerial photos that just kind of show how big a scale this pilot facility is. Just explain to listeners the whole purpose of doing that pilot, building that pilot plant, sort of scaling it down, and really what you're sort of hoping to gain from it.
So the whole idea in doing a pilot operation is essentially to get a whole bunch of data that you would otherwise rely on third parties for. You would rely on, you know, peer comparisons. You would rely on estimates and guesstimates. And when you found a project, the size, the scale, and the absolutely one of a kindness of Kasia, you know, there's no other rutile graphite deposit out there, let alone, you know, this being the largest rutile deposit in the world, second largest graphite deposit in the world. You don't go building a huge world-scale operation immediately and then try and figure out the bumps in the road as you go. The better way to do it is what we're doing, which is you start off with a small pilot scale operation, you work out those bumps in the road on the smaller end, and then you know exactly what you should be doing when it comes to the full operation. And you know, you alluded to this being quite a large scale pilot site. You know, it's about 10 hectares, and in reality, that's less than a square kilometer, and our mineralization, our resource, covers 200 square kilometers. So, you know, this is really, I would say,
about 0.5% of your total area, basically.
Pretty much, and look, we'll be mining about 150,000 bench cubic meters over the course of the next 6 months, compared to what our steady state operations would look like. I mean, you're talking less than 1.5% of the actual full scale operation.
So, Sapan, is one of a kindness actually a word or a phrase?
It is now, Kevin.
Very good. Well, now we're in this one of a kindness project. What I would say to you is, can you give anybody an idea? What is the magnitude of this that you're actually doing now? You know, the actual size in comparison to maybe, you know, a normal mine. Is it, you know, tiny? Is it what people would normally mine? You know, give us an idea.
No, we don't. Look, we're doing things. This is a world scale project, right? When we mine this for 25 years at the size and scale we're talking about, we'll still only have mined 30% of the known resource, and we'd be going across multiple pits in different parts of the resource, all simultaneously, all at different time, or across different locations. So when you look at this pilot scale, you've got to understand it is pilot. It is a small scale for Kasia, albeit it's probably the size of many other mining operations, kind of main operational scale. But this is a whole other beast.
And how long do you expect that this process will take? I mean, are you going to be in this process for the next 6 months, 12 months. You know, once it started, you expect that it will continue indefinitely, effectively, just as a startup in terms of the whole process that will go on?
The idea is to do this pilot phase for the next 6 months. But as it's not just pilot mining, it's also land rehabilitation. And obviously, the rehabilitation data will continue to gather for several months post the mining phase. You know, I think I've said to you guys before, one of the key things for any project, whether it's, you know, kind of tier one like Casilla or anything else, for any mining company today to operate well within any jurisdiction, you need local community support and you need governmental support, right? And if you don't have those, then you're kind of you're walking backwards. So one of the key things we wanted to understand, and what this pilot phase will hopefully demonstrate, is that once we've removed the commodities, the minerals that are important to us as sovereign metals out of the ground and backfilled and put back the materials from where we found them, that soil, that earth, is just as agriculturally useful and yielding as it was before, if not better in some cases. So that's what we want to demonstrate to the local community, to the local farmers, indeed the individuals whose ground we're currently mining on.
And the product that you mine is going to be going where?
So any product that we end up processing and end up producing within our lab facilities in Malawi will either, we will test it internally, but a lot of it will go to end users, the rutile product, or whether that's the graphite concentrate. You've probably seen that we're doing a lot of work on the graphite concentrate and getting that qualified for use in the lithium-ion battery space. That work continues. So if we can continuously produce that graphite con from this pilot phase, that will give us a good amount of sample to provide to labs who are doing a lot of that test work and that qualification for us.
Okay, that's very good. So what's happening then with Rio Tinto? We've obviously seen the share price move up. What is the option price at now? Or not now, what was it at?
So look, Rio Tinto came in as a strategic investor for 15% at a price of 48.6 Australian cents. They have an option to go up to 19.99 at a price of 53.5 cents. I'll let you do the FX in terms of what that means for AIM, but we're looking at about 29-ish p, I think, off the top of my head.
Okay, so they're in the money then, basically, on this option as it stands. And obviously, you've been high as 33, I think, 34p over the last week or two. So that's obviously a positive, which would give you more cash to progress the thing. And obviously, how are they helping you in terms of experience, in terms of Rio?
Well, when you have the world's largest titanium dioxide producer with 150 years of legacy mining knowledge, with all the supply chains intact, with our own potential customers, end users, with all the labs, with even the political prowess of the ninth largest company on the FTSE 100, you can imagine all the IP that they bring to Sovereign. So, you know, notwithstanding, we have a technical committee made up of three Rio individuals, three Sovereign individuals, and Sovereign has kind of chairmanship of that committee. But the investor agreement was for them to help us both in terms of the technical and the marketing aspect of Casilla. They are assisting in both of those really on a day-to-day basis.
Very good. So what are we going to see the next steps coming out then? What do we expect to see on Twitter? I presume you're probably going to have some advisors flying out there as well through to have a look.
Yeah, so if you do go on our, like, you know, to our RNSs and our social media, you'll see just the progress that we're making week on week site. Things are moving very fast. And they will be for the next 6 months. So we'll keep the market informed on the site. In the background, we continue to do work on our graphite. We should have a lot more information coming from the labs in terms of what our graphite looks like in a battery and how it acts in a battery. And we should have that in the coming weeks. There are other bits and pieces of work happening within Malawi itself, both, you know, us in terms of our own social initiatives, but also in terms of a lot of infrastructural work and upgrading that the Malawian government's currently doing, all of which you know, directly or indirectly will benefit us at Sovereign. So yeah, lots of news to come out over the next couple of weeks. In terms of getting people out on site, we had some analysts out on site about a month ago. We're planning on taking investors and hopefully yourselves out on site come towards the end of July, beginning of August sometime. So you can actually appreciate, you know, as I like to say, the size and scale of this.
Yeah, the vastness of it. Okay, one last question for me, just so people can sort of understand the potential size of this is, let's assume this all goes to plan and then the CapEx is spent and we get to the point where we are producing X amount. What is the revenue that is going to be generated from the rutile and the graphite on an annual basis?
Yeah, so in terms of an annual basis on just the rutile and graphite revenues, I mean, you're talking a total revenue of $16 billion over the course of the 25 years. On an average annual basis, you're talking around $650 million US dollars a year. And that translates to an EBITDA, or, you know, for lack of a better word, a gross profit of about $415 million US dollars. So, you know, well, I think our market cap is probably, what, about 6 months of future annual EBITDA at the moment. So therein lies the investment case. And remember, as I've said before, this is all based on a 25-year mine life, but this thing can just go on
and on, yeah. And also, it's got the after-tax IRR, if I remember rightly, 28%, which is very impressive.
Yeah, look, I think the numbers all speak for themselves. Some investors may look at our CapEx and think, "Oh, that's a high CapEx." But look, this is a tier one project. You don't get tier one world class projects that last for decades for pittance. If you did, let me know and I'll go have a look.
No. I think you've got a bit of room for maneuver there in terms of how much money this thing's going to actually make. And I mean, I think it's also dependent on how much rutile and how much graphite is required in the world. You know, you could probably mine this faster as well in terms of the fact that you could have bigger mining and bigger plants, et cetera, I think, in time. But again, that's for another story and another day, maybe. But yeah, it's been a pleasure catching up with you again. And yeah, we look forward to going out to Malawi and seeing what's going on.
Yeah, look, it would be great to get you guys there. It's a very simple site visit. It's not hours on end to get to Kasia. We're only, what, 45 kilometers outside of the capital city by road, like the main road. So you could do this site visit in a day. That's the reality of it.
That's good.
Sounds good. Sounds better than 18 hours in the back of a truck.
18 hours in a car in Zambia was not that much fun, I have to be honest. But there you go.
No, this is much more socially acceptable, shall we say.
On that note, we'll say Sapangai, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay, let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of the week. Clontarf, Superdry, and Landor were the best three movers, with Clontarf up well over 100%. So again, the market showing signs of stocks that are reacting to news. The big one, the sort of mainstream stock, was Apple. I don't know if you saw that, but shares in Apple rose to a record high early in the week after it unveiled a deal to integrate artificial intelligence ChatGPT into the iPhone, iPad, and Mac. Shares rose 3.5% in early trading to $199. And Apple said that alongside its Apple intelligence system giving users access to AI-powered tools, it would also give users access to ChatGPT. So I think we talked about this in the week, didn't we? That it was between Apple and NVIDIA, who was the highest market cap, and Apple kind of took over again, didn't they, in the week?
Just the $2 trillion that it's worth. It's like,
I hit you with that fact.
I mean, NVIDIA is $3.2 trillion market cap.
Yeah.
I mean, just think about that.
So that one company is now worth, NVIDIA is now worth more than the entire FTSE 100, as they announced the cashed in on the AI boom as well. So literally, as you say, that $3.2 trillion is worth more than the largest UK companies, the FTSE 100, every single company that's listed.
Yeah, and to put it in perspective, NVIDIA is worth six times the value of Tesla.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were saying that as, you know, the bellwether, the one that everybody was, you know, this is going to be the stock for the millennia, if you like. And here we are. I was just trying to look up what the actual market cap of Apple was. I think they overtook it just about, didn't they? So.
They did it, yeah, sort of middle of the week. So the other one was Golden Metal Resources, that they had a good week. Obviously, they yeah. announced on Monday that they'd raised about just over $500,000 through the direct subscription with the existing investor Pure Bond. They raised at a premium price, the share price at 22.5p per share, which increased Pure Bond's ownership to 6.65% of the large share capital. And obviously they're going to use the funds to accelerate exploration and development of the Garfield and Pilot Mountain projects. No warrants were issued, and Oliver highlighted the company's flexibility to expand ongoing work and the support from Pure Bond and all shareholders. So great news this week. And obviously then there was an announcement on an update, wasn't there, on the actual Pilot Mountain as well, I believe.
Yeah, it just keeps getting better, to be honest. You got a situation there where I think it's over 70% of that those shareholders are all in TR1 type investments, obviously with Power Metal. I would imagine just less than 50% now that we've had that other Pure Bond thing. So, but you've got, like, I think it's 73% of all shares are in TR type people. And I know for sure that there is another probably 3 to 7%, let's say, to take it up to 80%, that is in very, very tight hands, and they're not going to be selling. So it's got a very, very small free float. We saw it go up to, I think, 27, came back down again to 24. And I think finished the week at 25. But when you actually look at the market cap, regardless of the price, you know, the market cap is still only, I think, somewhere in the region of 26, 27 million pounds. Well, this tungsten deposit, if they extend it, even if they don't extend it, has to be worth many, many, many multiples of that as a market cap. And that's yeah. without the copper porphyries that they're talking about, and the gold also, and they've got lithium, various different assets. I mean, it really is one of those ones that you can just keep, you can see it's yeah. just going to keep on giving, you know. I really do. And we talked about Incantera last week as well. That had a good week as well. I think finished the week at 27.5, I think it was the mid price. And again, another one, market cap, you know, probably somewhere in the region of 30 million, with revenues going to be well in excess of that, you know, in the not too distant future. So again,
and they've got some good, you know, good investors, institutional investors on board as well. Just going back to the GMET 1 second, they actually now, Golden Metals now has 67.5% of its shareholders as TR1 notifiable, and that really matters. I mean, what does that tell you? Nearly 70% of their shareholding is TR1 notified.
Yeah, and I personally know two people who have 1-2% as well. So, you know, you they ain't for selling. So you're well into the 70% that is in hands that either can't sell or won't sell, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, absolutely. It's going to be very, very interesting. The other one that we had, and we featured them on the roast a few weeks back, is an electric guitar, having bought Three Radical. This is all about the first party data, which I think is going to be a huge play in the future. In fact, not even in the future, it's sort of like now, and I think that was what they were trying to say. There has been a very big distress seller. We think they had well over 2% of the company, and they've been basically selling at any price for the last sort of week, I suppose. The shares plummeted from about 1.6 all the way down to 0.9p on no news, on nothing. So yeah, I can honestly say we were buyers. We bought under a penny. And at the end of the week, there it's recovered to 1.13. I think I saw it was at the end of the week. But that's a big opportunity. I think it'll be back to 1.6. And at the end of the day, it IPO'd at over 2p. And I think we'll see that back in no time, because basically, again, it's pretty tightly held, but there was a distressed seller. So that's an opportunity. Yeah. If you listen to that podcast, or if you didn't, go back and have a listen, because I really think what John's doing there with electric guitar is going to be a hell of a good technology play going forward. You know, they've got the client in Asia who is not Visa. So work it out for yourself.
Yeah. So, and they've done a lot of, there was an announcement, wasn't there, on the 6th of June, I think, that where they talked about big board changes, like sort of putting people in places, and it looked very good.
Yep, it's one of those opportunities that maybe, you know, you're buying in pretty much at half of what the IPO was only a month ago or so. You know, maybe those opportunities are worth having a look at.
Raspberry Pi, and I don't mean food. I mean the low-cost computer firm. They just did an IPO. I don't know if you saw that, but it came to market on Friday. They jumped by more than 40% on the Tuesday ahead of them being sold to retail investors. So they were trading at like 4.60p, so £4.60. And the IPO was at 2.80p, so there was quite an uplift on that one. It's good to see these sort of, I mean, Raspberry Pi has been around for a long time. They make these small kind of Linux-based small computers that you can learn. Children, you know, they use them in school and education, university, so people can build their own small computers with a processor and an HDMI port. Very, very, very interesting technology. So very good to see that one come to market with as a success. HE1, Helium1, bit of a nightmare week, heavily discounted placing to raise £8 million. They discounted the placing down to 56.5% to the closing price of 1.15 pence. There's about circa half a pence that they did that. So that came crashing down at the beginning of the week. Not sure, you know, obviously they raised quite a lot. They did well to get 8 million, but I'm not sure why they felt they needed to do it at such a hefty discount.
Yeah, another big performer this week, I don't know what it's up, you can maybe check the total for the week, was Kendrick Resources. It was at 0.3.
Well, I've got them listed actually on the notes here.
It's finishing at 0.53. And I think that was just on nothing really, because all that's happened is it's gone from a company that was worth $600,000 or $700,000 to one that's worth 1.1 million. And with all the assets that they've got, definitely had a much higher IPO. I think the IPO was over 3p. And it's still 0.5, you know, it's a crazy situation.
Yeah, it had a good day on Friday. It was up circa 20%, as you say, sort of 0.522, up 61% on the week itself. So a good week, Kendrick. Yeah.
From a low base, but yeah. First Class Metals. First Class Metals are coming back very soon. First Class Metals had sold two of their assets, so that really sort of proves the model. They're buying it up and then moving on. They put their accounts out, I think, on Friday, so they should be back to market probably Monday or Tuesday at the latest. Yeah, so that should be interesting. We had a conversation with James, Mark, and we're going to interview them as soon as they know for sure when they're coming back on the market, and we'll have a good chat with them and see what the situation is. The other person we met when we were in London was Sean Wade. Shout out to you, Sean, if you're listening. We had a curry with him. What night was it, Phil? Tuesday night. Yeah, it was nice. And Harry, who's the chairman of Chill Brands now. So that was nice. We didn't really talk business at all, to be honest. We talked about politics, about football, and it was very enjoyable evening. So thanks a lot.
Yeah. Was it refreshing, wasn't it? It was good. It was good to meet them, but good to meet Sean in the flesh, actually. So it was a very interesting chat. But so football, let's look forward to the start of the Euros. This the opening game, Scotland versus Germany. We had news this week that the psychic, you know, every year or every tournament we get this psychic. Sometimes it's the octopus. Guess what we've got?
I was going to say, is it an octopus?
No, it is Walter, the psychic orangutan. And guess what? He's picked his team ahead of the opening game on Friday between Germany and Scotland in the, as I say, the Euro 2024 competition. Do you know what he's went and picked? Which team he picked, Walter?
Yeah, Scotland.
No, he picked Germany. So
to win the whole tournament, you mean?
No, just Germany to win the just their first game.
That was a big game. He put his neck on the line for that one. If you picture,
well, there's a picture of him. I can send it. Yeah, there's a bucket that he's sat in this sort of like enclosure area, and he's got a bucket, and he's got the German flag on one, and he's got the Scotland on the other, and his hand is resting on the bucket of Germany. So maybe they sort of, you know, put some food in that he liked into that one, and just to sort of, you know, just to fix it. I don't know, but it certainly proof is there that he said, yeah, so we'll find out, I guess. What about our chances against Serbia on Sunday evening after this goes out?
Yeah, well, let's just hope they do it. You know, I think England will do well if they attack and if they don't just sit back. So I hope Southgate just realises that he has to go and get involved, you know, allow the people to use their skills and get in there.
Yeah.
Because we aren't going to defend our way to the championship, because our defences are not looking particularly good, especially central defence. They look so scary, you know. And it's saying something, because we've left Mr. Whatever his name is, Donkey, because he's injured.
Harry Maguire.
Mr. Maguire. So, And we're all now thinking, oh, come back, Harry, because actually you're better than the ones that we would have had. So, yeah,
let's see.
It's going to be another 4 weeks, is it, of football and everybody chilling out, watching the football. It's always a good time. I like doing it. So, yeah, I'm going to the US Open. The US Open this weekend. Maybe by the time you've listened, they'll know who's won the US Open. But Rory McIlroy had a good first round. He was a joint leader at 5 under. But it made a fool of quite a few. I think Tiger Woods, I think he actually withdrew. I'm not sure whether he withdrew, but Phil Mickelson, 9 over par as well on the first day. So it was making a fool of some of the more famous golfers. But I actually fancy Bryson DeChambeau. So if you're listening to this after you know the result, and I'm right, I wish I'd put some money on it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
So there you go. A weekend of sport. Is there a
We've got Le Mans, the Le Mans 24 hour, which I'm down at. I've been down there this weekend watching that. So we've got Porsche Pedersker on pole positioning of the hypercar class. They've got very interesting lineup this year because they've got Peugeot back for the first time. Lamborghini are also taking part. Ferrari, who won it, they're the reigning champions from last year, are obviously in it. So you've got a pole with Porsche Pedersker. You've got Cadillac on 2 and 3, and then I think you've got Ferrari on 4 and 5. So very, very interesting lineup. And I say Toyota was sort of didn't do very well in the qualifying. Lamborghini spun out a couple of times, so I don't think they made the sort of top 6 or 7. So yeah, very interesting race. 24 hours. If you've never been, I'm heartily recommend it. And you sat at 3 a.m. on the Mulsanne Strait where they're hitting about 230 miles an hour, and you can see the brake is glowing and the sound of them. It's a phenomenal event. So very enjoyable. But
I just watched the film, the Le Mans film, that was to do with the Ford Ferrari. The Ford Ferrari challenge. What was the name of the film?
It was very good. Le Mans 66, yeah, with Christian Bale and I think Matt Damon in it, wasn't it? Yeah, Matt Damon and Bale.
Yeah, yeah. And who's the famous Ford designer now that everyone talks about?
It was Shelby, wasn't it?
Shelby. Shelby, who designed that car, and a driver who was driving who was superb
I can't remember his surname, but he was the absolute crazy driver. He took Mr. Ford out, didn't he, in the car, right. GT40.
That was Shelby that took him out.
Shelby took him out and scared the living daylights out, didn't he?
Yeah, he started crying and then he started laughing in the movie. It was a very good movie. Anyway, if you're into your own sports at all and you haven't watched it, I watched it on the plane and it was captivating. It was very good.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah, there's some good movies out there. So yeah, if you like what you've heard as well, I think it's been a great show. I think listening to the OTC markets and then obviously Sat talking about the pilot plan, I think it was a very enjoyable row. So if you like what you've heard, please subscribe and hit the bell icon so you get any further notifications on any future episodes.
Indeed. Thank you, guys and girls.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.